We're going to call the committee to order. This is the Wednesday, February 25th, 2015 meeting of the Transportation and Public Safety Committee. We are awaiting, we got a stronghold of Republican senators here and myself and Senator Jensen. We will start testimony on this on Senate File 1060, which has to do with trucks, but nothing to do with their weights.
That's
you have no sneaky amendments. Okay.
No amendment, Mr. Chair.
I'll declare a quorum present when we have that, and then we'll be able to take action. But in the meantime, why don't we go ahead and take testimony and presentation of the bill. Senator Jensen, to your bill, 1060.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today I'm talking about Senate File 1060. It has to do with the length limit exclusion currently in law, and I have some people here that would like to talk about it, and I think that we should just go ahead and hear their testimony.
Great.
That's okay.
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you. We have Kyle Kotke, Chair of the Minnesota Trucking Association Board of Directors, and John House-Lauden, Minnesota Trucking Association. Take it in whatever order you'd like,
yes.
Gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I'm John House-Lauden, President of the Minnesota Trucking Association. The MTA represents roughly 700 trucking companies and their allied vendors from across the state, and I'm proud to be here today with my elected chairman, Mr. Kyle Kotke, who will provide testimony on Senate File 1060, and we'll tag team on our comments. Senate File 1060 is essentially a federal conformity bill. If passed, it would allow truckers to use what we call trailer tails on all of Minnesota's roadways. Put simply, a trailer tail is a device that reduces drag by redirecting airflow at the back of a trailer. And you have a handout, a one-pager there, I believe, that has a diagram that describes that. Under the last federal highway bill, MAP 21, trailer tails were authorized for use on the national network. And as you know, that's the interstates and some designated state routes. However, the State Patrol brought to our attention the fact that they're not technically permitted on all routes, particularly those more than a mile off of the national network. Adding these tails put the trailer roughly 5 feet over the maximum statutory limit of 53 feet. So Senate File 1060 modifies the statute to permit their use, and the State Patrol supports our efforts to bring clarity for roadside enforcement. And I want to stress, as the Chair mentioned earlier, this bill does not allow trucks to haul any more freight, any more weight. It simply allows us to add foldable and easily collapsible panels at the rear of the trailers. And now Mr. Kotke will describe the benefits of using these devices.
Thank
Welcome
you,
to the
Mr.
Committee.
Chairman.
Mr. Kotke, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse
I'm Kyle Kotke.
Excuse me. We have a quorum. Okay, proceed.
I'm Kyle Kotke, and I'm the general manager of Kotke Trucking in Buffalo Lake, Minnesota. We're a third-generation family-owned trucking company, primarily hauling refrigerated food goods on 85 tractors across the entire United States. We're currently experimenting with 12 trailer tails on our fleet currently. The concept behind a tail is quite simple. As you can see from the handout that we've given you, it creates, at road speeds, it creates less air turbulence and reduces drag. This turbulence creates a dragging effect, which causes the truck to use more fuel. By adding these trailer tails, we eliminate drag. This improves vehicle stability, reduces driver fatigue, and improves visibility in wet weather. The tails are deployed when traveling down the roadway, then collapsed and folded away when backing up to a dock. They do not obscure trailer safety lighting, reflective tape, or placards. They're placed high enough that they do not interfere with any other vehicles. The manufacturer has demonstrated fuel savings of greater than 5%. Our trucks outfitted with these devices are saving approximately 5.5%. The financial payback on these devices depends on the price of fuel. The higher the fuel, the quicker the payback. Using a rate of $3 per gallon in a truck that burns 20,000 gallons annually at the manufacturer's 5% savings estimate, the projected payback is 7 to 8 months. However, the environmental payback to everyone is immediate. Improved fuel economy means less fuel burned and thus fewer carbon emissions. Trailer tails are not right for every trucker, but in certain applications, they can be a valuable cost-saving tool. I urge you to pass Senate File 1060 so that trailer tails can be used on all Minnesota roads where they make sense.
Thank you, Mr. Kotke. Questions, members? All right. One moment. So I'll just state for the record, this does meet federal conformity, except that we also include recreational vehicles. That's what the online 1.10 or 3C refers to. 3C refers to recreational vehicle combination, which I don't have an issue with. I just wanted to make that clear that that's not a function of federal regs.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Just
a good Minnesota idea. Senator Jensen, do you have a motion?
I do.
Go ahead. Yeah, I think we just go to the floor. I don't think we have a...
I move Senate File 1060 be...
recommended to pass.
Recommended
to
pass and sent to the general orders.
All right.
The floor.
Perfect.
Got it?
All right. Any questions on the motion? Nope. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion carries.
Thank you. Thank
you. All right. I saw Senator Latz. Senate File 86.
I was going to say, Mr. Chair, I thought all these testifiers were here for that bill.
They are. Now they're all going to leave the room. So Senator Latz has Senate File number 86, which has to do with automatic license plate readers. Members, this is in front of the Transportation Committee, Transportation Public Safety Committee, because it touches on some matters that pertain to driver and vehicle services data, as well as state patrol utilization of these devices that there are some questions about. I'll state for the record that the subject of data classification and treatment of data is a subject of the Judiciary Committee. I'll say that for the record because that's been the point of some conversation in Rules Committee and elsewhere. That being said, of course, we're not totally restricted in committee. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You don't want to hear about tails on semi-trucks from me?
We could hear about overweight. Like we could hear about overweight trucks from you. That's always an interesting conversation.
We'll talk about that on the floor, I guess. Members of the committee and Mr. Chairman, Senate File 86 amends Chapter 13, the Data Practices Act, to classify law enforcement data, and in particular including the length of retention of that data and restrictions on access to this law enforcement data. This is a data practices bill that addresses specifically the use of automated license plate readers. These devices are technology that can scan license plate information automatically. And these devices, or LPRs, are mounted on squad cars and on stationary objects. Essentially, it is automating what is already done by human law enforcement officers as they are driving or walking, reading license plate information, putting it into their mobile data terminals, and running that information against other law enforcement-related databases to determine whether or not a vehicle is stolen, to determine whether or not the registered owner is licensed to drive that vehicle, and so on. This data, as is collected by a government entity, is by default, under the Data Practices Act, classified as public data. In 2013, the Information Policy Analysis Division, IPAD, of the Office of Administration, classified LPR data temporarily as private until August 1, 2015, in order to allow time for the legislature to consider whether we wish to take specific action with regard to the classification of this law enforcement collected data. After August 1, 2015, if the legislature does not act, all of this data again becomes public, and there will be no guardrails or rules regarding its retention or access to it, other than what this legislature has passed in other last year with regard to general access to data that is protected. As the debate over the how to regulate this LPR technology has progressed, the primary concern of legislators did not appear to be the data classification. All legislators seem to agree that this data should not be public, but rather was on how long the law enforcement agencies should be allowed to keep the data to aid in criminal investigations. As you will hear from testifiers today, the LPR data is an invaluable tool in solving crimes and in apprehending those who commit those crimes. The alternative to allowing law enforcement to retain the data to solve crimes is to only allow law enforcement to use LPR devices to identify hits, or as they refer to them as reads, on license plates that are immediately connected to an already known crime. If there's no hit, the data would be immediately destroyed and unable to be used in criminal investigations that are ongoing. I disagree with limiting the potential of LPR devices to identifying hits for the reasons that you will hear from law enforcement. Last year, a bill that was authored by Senator Champion allowed for the retention of LPR data by law enforcement for 90 days. This was a compromise number, as law enforcement had come into last year's legislative session wanting to retain the data for 180 days. The opposite position of a zero-day retention was maintained by the House. In the course of working through this process, a compromise was struck in the Senate. I should say not only in the House, but other members of the Senate as well. A compromise was struck at 90 days. The 90-day provision passed unanimously out of the Senate Judiciary Committee last year, and it passed unanimously on the Senate floor and went to conference committee, where it did not emerge from. In conference committee last May, there were a couple of issues that caused the bill to not be concluded at that time. Concerns about the retention period of the data, and also concerns about the protection of individual privacy if the data were retained, and how to deal with issues of exculpatory evidence that the data may have, and private party LPR use. In other words, privately owned and used LPR devices that would then transmit or share their data with law enforcement agencies.
And Senator Latz, just because we're not judiciary, and I apologize if you all know what exculpatory means, but it means information that would prove someone's innocence.
Got it.
Thank you.
So this year, in the Judiciary Committee, we took those concerns and other concerns expressed by stakeholders, including the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information, Rich Neumeister, the ACLU, and others. We took those issues seriously, and we made a number of amendments. I will note that the Judiciary Committee, because the Senate passed a strong, unanimous 90-day provision last year, I reintroduced the bill this year that had, in exact language, passed the Senate floor last year. And honestly, I didn't anticipate that it was going to become a highly controversial bill in the Senate. I want to give you an analogy to why I think there's some value to retaining this data. I'm sure you've all seen television shows that talk about crime and investigation of crime. I can probably spend 15 minutes listing those that are so popular on TV. You've probably noticed that after a crime occurs, they go to the crime scene, they investigate it, they look around, they take their data, they gather their evidence, and then they go back to the crime lab, and they go back to their offices, and they look at that data, and they think about it, and they look at this angle and that angle. Well, and sometimes, in fact, probably almost every time, they come up with new questions that they still need to answer. or new evidence that they want to go try to find. So they may revisit the crime scene. They may go look in a place that they may not have looked before, or they may be looking for something specific that now they think may actually be there that they might not have noticed before, or that they didn't think was relevant before, but now maybe it is. And they'll go investigate in other locations as well. This could happen days or weeks after the initial crime has occurred. If that crime scene has been completely cleaned up and sanitized, then there's nothing left for them to go back to look at, and there may have been valuable evidence lost. But they do continue to investigate crimes, and it may be a while before they solve that crime. Often those clues don't arise until long after the crime itself has passed. So with that in mind, and with the other concerns that were raised by stakeholders, we amended the bill in Judiciary Committee on the course of two separate hearing days and with 9 total amendments. The bill was amended to include language that requires any private use of LPR device to comply with the bill if the data it collects is shared with law enforcement. This, for example, would include with the Mall of America, which privately owns cameras that it has in its ramps, but then shares that data information with the Bloomington Police Department. This data, again, really is only useful if the data is shared with law enforcement so that law enforcement can utilize that to cross-reference against driver and vehicle services data on licenses and motor vehicle registration to identify the location and the owners of these vehicles. In committee, the bill was amended to require an independent triennial audit of records to ensure that the data is destroyed as required and that law enforcement is complying with the law in terms of access and utilization of that data. The bill was amended to protect the retained data by only allowing access by law enforcement under specified conditions. These conditions include that the law enforcement agency must have written procedures. And those procedures, by the way, must also follow a model policy that is to be developed by the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board. Law enforcement can only access data when they have been authorized in writing by the head of the law enforcement agency. That means the chief, the sheriff, or a specific designee of the chief or sheriff whose responsibility it is to review requests by their investigating officers for access to this data. Access to the data may only be allowed for a legitimate, specified, and documented law enforcement purpose. So no fishing expeditions, no random searches just to see what may turn up. No looking at the data to find out if an officer's boyfriend or girlfriend was at home that night or was out of town, as they said they were going to be out of town. Those kind of things would not only be illegal under this bill, but would also be prohibited by legislation that we passed into law last year, making it a misdemeanor crime to access, generally, to access data for a purpose that is not authorized by law. And access to the data would only be based on a reasonable suspicion that the data are pertinent to a criminal investigation, a specific criminal investigation, and the request for access must include a record of the factual basis for the request and an associated case number, complaint, or incident that is the basis of the request. In addition, that data may not be shared with any other law enforcement agency unless that agency also follows the same procedures. The bill was also amended to allow the data to be preserved if an individual who is the subject of a pending criminal charge requests that the data be preserved for the purposes of exculpatory evidence. As Chair Dibble explained, evidence that they believe might be helpful in exonerating them from the criminal charges that they are facing. So retaining the data not only benefits law enforcement in determining who commits crimes, but also those who could use that data to prove that they did not commit a crime, that they weren't in a particular location or city at the time that they are accused of being. If their data shows that their vehicle was located 10 miles away at the same time they were supposedly at a crime scene. It's important also for members to recall, and I've made a reference to this, that last year the legislature did pass a bill that punishes the misuse of government data by public employees as a misdemeanor crime, as well as providing notice and reporting requirements. So that's already existing law, and that would cover this data as well. So with that, Mr. Chairman, and the background that I've tried to provide here, I'm happy to answer questions. We do have testimony available, prepared to respond to issues that may arise, and I'll leave it to the discretion of the chair whether you wish for me to have that testimony presented now or if you wish to go on with your discussion. We're ready to respond as necessary.
I suspect we won't get to the testimony if we open up the conversation immediately, and there are a lot of people who traveled here to share their thoughts with us. With the indulgence of the committee and with the request of the testifiers that there are about a dozen of you, keep our comments as brief as possible and try not to completely repeat previous testimony. Why don't we go to testimony? And so we have an order on the agenda. Looks like we have a number of representatives of police agencies, so we'll start with Jeff Potts of the Bloomington Police Department.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thanks for giving us the time here to present a little bit of information on the automated license plate readers. What we'd like to do is just start with just a real fast overview by way of PowerPoint of what LPR is, and to try and maybe provide a little bit of a little bit more information on what the technology is. But first, let's start with really a slide that kind of establishes what it's not. There is some, I think, misunderstanding on the technology, and so we try to just articulate what some people have referred to LPR as being, as a video recorder. It's not a video recorder. It's not a tracking device. When we talk about tracking devices from law enforcement, a lot of times we're talking about a device that gets mounted on a vehicle, like an actual device that gets put on the bottom or somewhere on a vehicle, or even on a phone, cell phone, what have you, that you can actually, through GPS, track where that device goes. That is not what LPR is. LPR can give a specific location of a vehicle, but only when it passes by or when a squad car that has LPR technology mounted on it or it passes by a fixed location, it can tell you where that vehicle was at that point in time. That is the extent to which it can track. A vehicle travels from point A to point B. If a vehicle passes by a squad car one time and that license plate is read, it has one location. That's as much as it can do in terms of a tracking device. It is not networked across jurisdictions. The data that is not networked from one agency to another, and it does not capture every Minnesotan's plate. Again, I go back to when a vehicle or when a squad car that has LPR technology passes by a vehicle, it can take a picture, a scan at that point in time, and it geotags it. Or when that vehicle passes by stationary units, those are the vehicles that data will be retained in the system when it reads those license plates. In terms of how many LPR systems there are, how many agencies that is in Minnesota are using it, this survey is fairly recent, as you can see on the slide. 17% of law enforcement agencies in Minnesota right now, that comes down to about 24 police agencies in Minnesota are currently using LPR. In reasons why LPR is a valuable tool, it automates what police officers have always done, and that is running license plates manually with their hands, have to type into the keyboard. Vehicles, as you can see in the picture, have these devices mounted on the top and or on the trunk, and they automatically take a picture of the license plate. The system can then convert that picture into letters and numbers, and as Senator Lance mentioned, it then will run that license plate against a hot list, which we'll get to here in just a second. It allows the officers to be more efficient It allows the officers to be more efficient in how those license plates are run. They're not looking down at a keyboard manually doing that as often. That the system can do that for them. How it works, typically they're mounted on a car, on a squad car, as the picture indicates. In Bloomington, as was mentioned, we have a stationary system at the Mall of America. I think certainly in light of some recent commentary about Mall of America and terrorism, there's probably good reason, I think, for us to have LPR at the Mall of America. It is actually owned by the city of Bloomington. There is no sharing of data with the Mall of America. It is a private-public partnership with the mall that we have, and we have an agreement with them that allows us to mount this technology over in and on areas near the Mall of America. It's automated, high-speed camera can collect these pictures at a speed of 180 miles an hour. That would be a closing the combination of the two vehicles. The technology can really only take pictures up to 80 miles an hour in each direction. So if there's vehicles traveling in both directions, the top end is 160 miles an hour, but that's the capability in terms of how fast the vehicles can be traveling when the system will still capture the image. It takes a snapshot of the vehicle's license plate and records that at a date, time, and location. That's what it does. It takes a snapshot of the vehicle's license plate, and sometimes it'll capture more than just the license plate. The vehicle may be within only a few feet. It may be, quite a few feet, and depending on the distance there is where it kind of determines how much will be in the actually what you can see in the picture. But it then can convert those license plate to letters and numbers and run it against a hot list. It scans it against, as you can see, a hot list of stolen vehicles. The hot list can also includes missing persons, Amber Alerts, that kind of a thing, warrants. We say terrorist hot list. The actual name of that database is the Violent Gang and Terrorist Organization File. If a vehicle is in that system, the officer will get what's called a hit. It'll have an alarm, and it doesn't collect any personal data. This system does not have the name of the registered owner. This system has it literally is capturing an image and a geotagged image where that vehicle was at a set time, at a set date and time. When you have a hit, when a vehicle's license plate is in the hot list and the LPR reads it, alarm goes off, that's called a hit, and the officer can act immediately. If it's a stolen car, they arrange with other officers to safely try to stop that vehicle. If a vehicle is in the hot list for a warrant, that means that vehicle is at least at times driven by someone who has a warrant. The hot list will indicate a hit, and the officer will take immediate action on the vehicle, on stopping the vehicle. That is the hit data. That is vehicles that are entered into this series of hot lists. Hit data versus read data. Sometimes the reads, reads are referred to a scan or maybe a non-hit. Technically, the system refers to them as a read. That is when the system reads a license plate. That read is not instantly connected to a known crime. That means that read, that license plate, is not in the hot list. Stored at varying retention rates in Minnesota, anywhere from 48 hours to 90 days right now. That's the range that we see in terms of the 24 agencies in Minnesota that are using LPR. There's a range of 48 hours to 90 days. The value of the read data, this again is the vehicle's license plates that are held in the system for up to 90 days. It expands the investigative capabilities of that agency. Identifies possible suspects. If you know a license plate of a vehicle that someone's in, information can be very valuable in cases. It rules out innocent people, as was mentioned here today. Provides evidence to bolster prosecution. The value of read data, and again, we're going to start maybe telling just a few examples of cases where this read data was very valuable. The first example is a Bloomington case. A couple years ago, when we really just started using LPR systems, we had a case that involved objects that were being
basically hit by vehicles on a major thoroughfare in Bloomington, Normandale Boulevard. The first three or four, we really didn't, the victims didn't really know what happened. They just thought that their vehicle hit some debris on the road. We later were able to figure out that a lot of the debris seemed to be kind of consistent. The first were very similar to the bottle sitting in front of Senator Carlson. It was actually a bottle of water, but it was about that size. It was impaled in the radiator of a car, broke through the grill and impaled in the radiator. There were a couple more incidents with items just like that, and then it progressed, and we were getting reports from people for this unusual damage. A few more incidents happened, and we noticed now devices like a dumbbell, 15-pound dumbbell that had been hacksawed in half. It was now impaled in a radiator, and people really started, we started to really think there's something more than just road debris here. Didn't have any suspect information at all. A lot of these were happening at night. Officers just were in the area, but we weren't seeing it, and we were really struggling with this case. About the 13th incident was this device you see in the picture. It's a piece of, it's a steel vise from a mechanical vise that you might find in a machine shop. I'd like to see if I could have somebody hand these around. Can we just pass some photos and you folks can look at them as I'm telling about this, just to maybe would help save some time. What happened in this case was that the steel vise that's in the picture there was probably the most significant. It went through the windshield of the car. It punctured it just instantly. It hit the steering wheel and bent the steering wheel and then hit the driver in the mouth. It caused him to go unconscious. Happened to have a passenger in the car who quickly grabbed the emergency brake and the steering wheel and brought the car safely to a stop on Normandale Boulevard. Our officers got there, and these pictures really kind of try and show you this case just a little bit, all the way from the device that was thrown to some of the pictures of the injured person. We realized that this was one of our most serious cases in terms of somebody throwing objects out of the vehicle. And our detectives were working this case. We had officers hiding behind snowbanks at night to see if they could catch who was doing this. We were really at a loss. We didn't have any good suspect because the vehicles, when they drove by, they could maybe say, yeah, I think someone was driving the opposite direction, but I didn't see who it was. I didn't really get anything. Through some good detective work, our detectives were able to develop a very light suspect, that a name of someone that we could identify barely, but we could connect a vehicle to this person through the state DVS records, and we ran that license plate in our LPR system, and we realized we had two reads. Those reads located that vehicle on Normandale Boulevard on dates when we had previous incidents. Now, the suspect told us he wasn't even in town. We had interviewed him, and so now we knew at least his vehicle was on Normandale Boulevard at the time. At least one of these incidents happened. We had two reads within a few minutes. Our suspect was a man by the name of Garrett Parks. He was no stranger to Bloomington PD. He had been arrested a few times. And so we took that a little further. We looked at the data that was in the LPR system. The data, the read data, was 64 days old when we looked for it. So it took us a little while to develop him as a suspect, but 64 days later, when we looked into the LPR database, we found those reads. If there was a short retention period, especially in this case, that data would not have been there. And if it were not for this LPR read, I'm not so sure that we would have been able to convict Mr. Parks. He ultimately pled guilty to first-degree assault. But our evidence in this case, our physical evidence, although we had some items, it wasn't stuff that we could directly link. It was a water bottle. Unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of fingerprints or anything like that. And so in terms of physical evidence, the case was not exceptionally strong. This evidence was key, I think, in securing a guilty plea by this guy. Next, we want to talk just a little bit about Part 1 crimes and when those crimes get reported. Senator Latz mentioned that it takes time for investigations to run their course, just like our case that I just spoke about. But there's also cases it takes a while for them to get reported to the police. So we did a little survey with the agencies that you can see on the slide. How many Part 1 cases were reported to the police?
What Part 1 crimes?
Part one crimes are considered serious crime. That includes homicide, rape, robbery, aggravated assault, arson, burglary, theft. That is part one crime. It's generally referred to as serious crime, but part one crime is more serious. Part two is the lesser. These are numbers from 2014 that show you when crimes were reported to the police in these four agencies. You can see in Bloomington, 212 cases, 212 crimes were reported to us 91 or more days after they occurred. So not only does it take time for the investigation to kind of run its course and develop information, we simply don't hear about them often until many, many days after the crime occurs. So as we talk about the data and the how, and, you know, as we try to have a discussion about what's a striking a balance on how long it should be retained, it needs to be done in context with the conversation of how we can secure the data, or what are the proper safeguards for the data. And once we can really address some concerns about the security of the data, maybe we can have a different discussion about the length of time in which we can hold it. The bill that Senator Latz is the author of has a lot of these things in it. There are some good safeguards. Restricted access. He talks about a responsible authority, meaning the chief or the sheriff or an organization can really has they're the gatekeeper to the data. And so it isn't something that somebody can search just because they're curious. It needs to be done in a way that goes through the responsible authority. Public audits. And other audits, there's the triennial audit requirement that requires an external agency to come in and audit the queries, looking at who looked at the data and what was their purpose. That's a provision in this bill. But we, if somebody wanted to come to a police department and asked if their data had been queried, that we call that a public audit, they can audit and see if their license plate is in the system and if anybody had queried it. And also the requirement for written policies and training regarding not only the access, as it says on the screen, but also the use of the system. An agency using this would be required to develop internal policy and conduct training prior to the use of it. That is the overview in the example from Bloomington. Now, I know we have a couple of other folks in the room here that want to talk about their examples. And the first one, I'd like to ask Chief Mike Ashenbrenner to come forward. He is the chief from Mendota Heights. And last year they had a case where one of their officers was tragically killed. And he's going to talk of how LPR was used in that case.
So thank you, Chief Potts. Welcome, Chief Ashenbrenner. And Chief Potts told a great story, but took a while to tell it. And we are limited. We have to be out of here by 3:30, just for your information. We have a number of folks who want to testify, and I know that senators want to get to some discussion. So,
Thank you. I'll try not to repeat. Committee, thank you very much for having us here today. The opportunity to present our side of the need, from my perspective, is that of a crime victim. I work in a small department. 85% of the departments in the state of Minnesota are the size of the Mendota Heights Police Department or smaller. That leaves us a big decision when we ponder something such as automatic license plate readers, where we're balancing costs with what we get from them. At this point, my department does not participate in that. Thank goodness that departments around us have made that commitment to move forward. We're constantly balancing public expectations, and unlike TV, forensics are not easy and or cheap. They are expensive, as we've gone through all of the certification processes around us. Police work is truly mostly boring and mundane, and getting out and doing the legwork, as Chief Potts has referred to here. On July 30th of 2014, the Mendota Heights Police Department experienced a officer homicide on duty while committing a traffic stop while attempting to stop someone. Started a long series of a lot of people doing the boring and the mundane, getting out, talking to people, backtracking, reviewing, looking at data, opening it up, checking it, cross-checking leads, and moving back and forth. It is always going to be a very labor-intensive process. Being in a small department, anything we can do to maximize the time that our men and women are able to get out and actually work is a wonderful thing. The resources are not going to become more abundant in the public sector, and this is a true way to extend. So as we were moving through that process and really watching our partners investigate Officer Patrick's death from the 20th. One of the things that came up was a St. Paul Reed data hit of the suspect vehicle in that car, which gave us very minimal amount of information, but it helped us confirm the license plate that we were looking for had been approximately two blocks away 29 days earlier. Had that been 30 days earlier and we had a 30-day retention period, we would not have had that. That information would not have been available to help tie the suspect to the area, tie the suspect to the vehicle eventually, and help put these pieces together. Again, this is a small part of a big occurrence, and as the victims of a crime, we realize how important it is to reach out and use every single resource available to either tie things together or to clear and exonerate people. With that coming to close not too long ago, we really learned a lot, and we would love to venture into this, but we need to be able to see the value coming out of this for our taxpayers to spend that money. And I thank you for your opportunity to speak.
Thank you, and I convey the condolences of the committee and myself on the loss of your officer, and our thoughts were with you during that difficult time. I know that Representative Schoen is here, who knew the officer and participated in that effort. Oh, he was here. He's not here anymore. Thank you very much. Questions, members? Okay. All right. I have Chief of the Duluth Police Department, Gordon Ramsey. Why don't we bring a couple of folks up so we can become a little more expeditious? I have Kevin Torgerson, Olmsted County Sheriff. Why don't you come to the table as well?
Mr. Chair, Chief. Committee members, I want to tell a quick story of an incident that happened in the summer of 2010 involving one of the more concerning crimes that can happen in our communities. It involved a child abduction. A 13-year-old young girl was walking her dog in West Duluth when a stranger pulled alongside of her and took control of her and put her and her dog in her trunk. He drove her over the state lines and on the other side of the St. Louis River, short distance into Wisconsin, tied her to a tree, and stripped her down and touched her. He left her there, and she was able to untie herself and get help at a nearby bar. When we initially had the report of this crime, we put many, many resources on it. Fortunately, about 6 months prior to this, based on a charge by many of our local officials, which is don't keep asking for more officers, but find innovative cost savings technology to keep us safe, we had been early adopters with the license plate reader. Just so happened that one of our license plate readers was deployed in West Duluth on the day of the incident. As we developed different leads in the case, several suspects came out. One in particular had crossed in front of Spirit Mountain past the squad car that deployed the license plate reader. Now, we found the suspect information was gathered about 3 days after the incident. That license plate reader data helped us corroborate many different elements of this case. It ended up being a very strong case. Was prosecuted by the federal government, and ultimately we got a plea of guilty without going to trial. And there's no doubt that the powerful evidence of the license plate reader, which corroborated a lot of the evidence that we had also collected, made this charge possible. So not only as a police chief, but also as a parent of a 7-year-old girl and a 4-year-old boy, to not have this data available to police to keep our community safe, it's critical that we have it. So there's been many other success stories, but that's probably the most powerful story out of Duluth, and I wanted to share that with you today. Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Sheriff Torgerson, welcome. Thank you.
Excuse me. I'm Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm William Martinez. I'm the Assistant Chief of the St. Paul Police Department. Okay. Prior to becoming Assistant Chief, I was a commander of our homicide unit for several years. I have give you a lot of examples where the LPR has been instrumental in our investigations. But I'd like to point out one that of a murder of a young of Leonard Allen Christensen on March 30th of 2002. We had had information before the two nights before. We had a drive-by shooting in that neighborhood. Witnesses said that they described an individual driving a van and the color of the van. The night before Mr. Christensen was murdered, we had another similar incident in the 600 block of Ashland. Again, the similarity was the van and the individual that was driving this van. The following night, Mr. Christensen was murdered. What was troubling about this was that we had an idea who one of the suspects was. We know that there was three people involved, but these individuals were they're violent criminals, and they had intimidated some of our witnesses. We were able to, about 32 days out, we were able to tie this individual to this van, and we got his cell phone. We did a search warrant on his cell phone, and we received LPR data that linked this individual to every one of these shootings that we had that he was involved in. So if we fast forward to like 3 weeks ago, we were able to get a conviction on one of his associates on 10 felony counts of aggravated assault. That led us to being able to charge three individuals in the murder of Mr. Christensen. So we're talking almost 3 years before we can get these individuals tried. But had it not been for that LPR data that linked this individual, because you said I wasn't there, I was nowhere in the area, we're able to link him to every one of these shootings as well as two other people. Again, I was the commander of the homicide unit at that time. The community was intimidated by the acts of violence by these three individuals, and they wanted some answers and they wanted some justice. And I don't blame them. We didn't get any witnesses other than that one person. But it had not been for the LPR data, we wouldn't have been able to convict this guy and subsequently charge three individuals for the murder of Mr. Christensen. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Assistant Chief Martinez. I didn't quite catch the years and the dates in which the murder
when we requested the LPR data, it was like 32 or 33 days after the murder happened.
And when did that occur?
In March 3rd of 2012.
Oh, 2012. I thought I heard 2002. Okay. Thank you. Chief Schnell, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at no time in our recent history has law enforcement faced the level of scrutiny that it does today. We welcome the opportunity to be part of a discussion to talk about police tactics, strategies, and the transparency. We understand that public trust is critical to effective policing and is essential to public safety. On October 26th of 2014 at 8:30 p.m., three men were approached outside of a Maplewood liquor store in the area of Rice Street and Larpinder. The men were asked to purchase alcohol by what we presume were underage persons sitting in a vehicle in that parking lot. Ultimately, the three adult men refused to purchase alcohol for those men. The three men went inside of the liquor store. And when those men came out of the liquor store, the people inside that vehicle in the car opened fire on the three men. Two were hit by gunfire. One man was killed. There were many people around during this incident. Witnesses described the suspect vehicle, which had fled the scene, as a small white four-door sedan. After getting some surveillance video from the liquor store, we were ultimately identified the car as an older Mazda 3. The police department had received numerous calls, and all available squads were sent to the scene on that day. In the days following the incident, there was a tremendous amount of disparate information that investigators had to sort through. Just more than a week later, as the leads slowed and the family began to question our commitment to locating the killers, investigators went back to review what might have been missed. One item that was recognized was the potential that one of our ALPR-equipped squad cars en route to the shooting call may have passed the white sedan as it left the area. While that information could have been accessed the night of the incident, as you can imagine, when these incidents occur, there's a lot of moving pieces. The ALPR ultimately provided us with four leads. As those leads were developing, new information was received, and we were able to pinpoint the specific vehicle that was ultimately located and connected to this murder. Ultimately, ALPR is a valuable technology. It's a tool. It helps us, can help us solve crime, hold offenders accountable, and importantly, bring restoration and completion to victims. The majority of the people I've talked to in my community support our use of this technology. Clearly, they expect and, in fact, demand that we use that data appropriately and responsibly. The provision of the current legislation provide those protections, and the sanctions for misuse and unlawful access that were enacted last year, I think, further speak to that. As police, we find ourselves frequently in the difficult position of being expected to leave no stone unturned in the course of our investigations. ALPR is one of those stones, wherein with reasonable, measured, and appropriate mechanisms of accountability, we can protect and we can protect both privacy and advance investigations to bring relief to victims. I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Chief Schnell. Mr. Setter from the BCA. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, go ahead.
Lieutenant Mike Nibby, Edina PD.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
Oh, it's okay. On August 1st, 2013, Edina officers responded to the theft of prescription medications at Walgreens Pharmacy in Edina. Video surveillance showed the suspect was wearing white latex gloves, and these gloves were later found a short distance away. The DNA inside the gloves led us to our suspect. October 24th, the same suspect returned to Walgreens and stole two more bottles of promethazine cough syrup with codeine in it. Detectives checked all data sources we had for information on the suspect, and it was determined that he could not be found with his address on his driver's license or his vehicle registration. We contacted Minneapolis PD's Strategic Information Center and asked if their LPR system had recorded our suspect's vehicle in their city. And they returned to us between September 29th and October 22nd of 2013. The suspect vehicle had been located six times in their city, twice in the 3100 block of Lindale. Using this information, my detectives located the suspect's vehicle about a block away from where the LPR system had found it twice. Surveillance was set up, and the suspect was subsequently located and arrested. My detective said the LPR system was instrumental to locating the suspect and making the arrest.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. My apologies, Mr. Setter.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Wade Setter. I'm the superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I'm not here to share any stories. The BCA does not own any of these. But I just want to draw your attention to section lines 3.1 through 3.21, which is a requirement, excuse me, under Senator Latz's bill, for the BCA to be notified by local agencies, law enforcement agencies, of fixed-mounted LPRs, and then we'd post them on our public website. Under line 3.18 to 3.21, there's a reference to the fact that if the agency makes a request and determines that the location of the specific reader of security information as defined under 1337, which is a security declaration of Chapter 13, we would not list it on the website because it would be non-public information. We just do not have the ability to have the content of the justification for the security declaration, so that is a difficult provision for us to comply with in terms of making a determination over the objection of the responsible authority from the local agency.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Setter. We'll return to that conversation in a moment. All right. We'll move on to Don Gemberling. And I also have Rich Neumeister on the list. Oh, first I should ask, Senator Latz, is that the extent of the test fires you have?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, so we'll move on to Don Gemberling and Rich Neumeister. Thank you.
Uh, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Don Gemmerling. I'm the spokesperson for something called the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. MINCOGI, which is in the acronym, is a group of volunteer people composed of attorneys, citizens, media folks, librarians, who are dedicated to the proposition that you keep government accountable by having the maximum amount of government information available to the public. Our comments on the automated license plate reader bill are kind of as follows. Consistent with our kind of main mission, particularly when you accept the fact that we currently live in a surveillance society in which lots of people watch us doing everything we do, including those people who watch us when we go online. When you try and balance the good things that people do by watching us, like you've heard for the last several minutes, by catching criminals, et cetera, you also have to look at how do we make sure that it's only good things that are happening. And our proposition essentially is you do that, sort of, to the extent possible, by having a maximum amount of transparency associated with what law enforcement does in this particular instance. Now, Senator Latz has been kind enough along the way to accept amendments for more transparency. However, I think there's still some questions remaining that you may want to probe. And they are as follows. I'm still not sure, and I've listened to this testimony several times now, just exactly to what databases do the LPR devices connect, okay? Now, I always hear about stolen vehicles. I always hear about wants and warrants. But that's about it. However, if you look at the City of Minneapolis application for temporary classification, which Senator Latz referenced, what you'll see is a longer list of databases to which these devices connect. If you read news and you listen, I think it's safe to assume that one of the databases that they connect to is some kind of terrorism database. Okay? Now, how you get into a terrorism database, we don't know for sure. Okay? Historically, lots of people got into something that people thought was a terrorist database, including people like union officials, executives of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and that's part of our history. So I'll give you another example. One of the databases listed in the Minneapolis application was something called a BOLO database. Now, years ago, I worked on criminal justice information systems, and so I know that acronym means be on the lookout for, okay? But again, I don't know who we're being on the lookout for, okay? And I think at some point, to understand how these things really work and their real implications, you need to understand what databases they're hooked up to. One of your handouts, for example, the fairly thick one, is a series of news stories which include that the Drug Enforcement Administration is building a nationwide database of tracking vehicles across the country. So, and according to the article, at least, and I think it's a Wall Street Journal article, by the way, so I would hope it has some objectivity, the database is intended to cover the entire country at some point in the future. So understanding how this stuff is used, it may be helpful to your decisions. I have kind of a technical question because I spent a lot of time years ago interpreting the statute for other people. If you look at lines 2.33 to 2.34, it says that the law enforcement agency has got to comply with certain provisions of the Data Practices Act. I assume Senator Latz does not intend that they only have to comply with those provisions, okay? But I've seen some very creative interpretations of the Data Practices Act over the years. So that's something you may want to clarify. Superintendent Setter raised the issue of security information. He referenced the statutory provision and basically said they're not sure that they could make those determinations. I think if part of transparency is making sure we know how these devices are being used, where they're being used, and that kind of thing, that if you invite law enforcement to classify data about operations as security information, I'm going to guess they'll take the invitation. So I think it might be helpful if you kind of clarified that a little bit and qualified it. An issue that came to me after this bill went through judiciary, and so I apologize for Senator Lass for what may be a surprise. Section 2 essentially says that the post board, Police Officer Standard and Training Board, is going to develop model policy and procedure, and if a law enforcement agency in a city or county adopts that procedure, then they will be in compliance in essence with the statute. And it occurred to me that at least in cities, there may be strong opinions by people on city councils as to how license plate readers ought to be used in their city and whether or not there ought to be limitations or whatever. And if I read the bill correctly, you may be taking away from those officials the ability to question and to shape their own local policies on license plate readers. I think that kind of summarizes our concerns, except I go reluctantly into the serious debate, which is the zero versus 90 days, okay? And our organization essentially has discussed this. We discussed it last year. And our position basically is we like zero retention, except when there are hits, essentially because in most cases the data that's being accumulated is data about people who've never done anything wrong, okay? And certainly never done anything wrong criminal. So that is, I think, the dilemma before you, zero versus 90 days. In practical terms, I can certainly see some arguments why zero is difficult to live with. As somebody, again, who's watched and worked this statute for 40 years, I have real questions as to how you make sure that happens, what the stick is if you don't comply with zero versus 90 days. And actually, that would be the case for either zero or 90 days. But those are decisions that I don't have to make. So, and any way in which we can be helpful to you, feel free to ask. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Gemberling. Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. I'm an open government and privacy advocate. Basically, there's no doubts about it. License plate readers is a tracking tool. A surveillance tool. Since 2010, I have done many, many data requests with over 15 agencies, sheriffs, and law enforcement agencies on how they use the license plate reader. I have gotten many manuals from those agencies that are pushed on to do this technology by the vendors. And how it's funded is a lot of it is through the Department of Commerce. Purposely, a lot of these folks got the cars or these tools for stolen cars. But then all of a sudden, agencies started to know how they could use these tools for other kinds of purposes. Now, what you have in front of you is a packet that I put together, and I want to use that as part of my testimony to highlight some of those issues. If you see, all of a sudden, you'll see it starts with the Star Tribune article. This is when, basically, the public, the legislators and folks found out about how a number of agencies were using this tool. If you look, basically, on page 2 of that article, you'll see down below there the number of reads in a particular month, 805,000 in Minneapolis, and only 6,100 hits. Throughout all my data requests from all these agencies, 99.5% were reads, scans on innocent and law-abiding people, with 0.5% being hits from the database. If you look on the third page, you'll see a picture of where Ryback, what happened at that time, it was public, and so you'll see some of the qualities of some of the pictures. Now, the other thing that you have on page 5, these are the kinds of pictures that you'll see, let's say, for example, in a small town or in a large town that has several LPRs. This is the kind of information that they'll collect. Again, it's the license plate, and that's the crux of the issue here. a license plate that's registered to millions of cars in Minnesota, that's registered to many, to millions of individuals and families. So the point is also, you see the pictures. Now the next, on page 6 and 7, you'll see these are cumulative in months. Again, I just bring this out. It gives you more examples. This is what you can get using data practices where it's only so many. The other point, you'll see a map of...
Mr. Newmaster, I think you're going to have to hold those up. I think these were not provided to us electronically. Is that correct?
Do you have this? Weren't they in the packet?
Okay, I guess we do have it, but the page numbers are a little different. We have it in this packet here. So.
Yeah, I was told that they were in the packet. So that's why I was referring to them.
So I think it was formatted slightly differently so that we could put it in electronic form for one of the members of our committee. So anyways, continue, and we'll try to figure out, try to track along with what you're referring to.
Also, you'll also see a map of Ryback's travels, 27 within a short period of time. Again, this is where the tracking happens, where the cumulative information. Now, also that you have provided is the Village and Solutions. Now, this is the information, basically, what ALPRs pick up. Color image of vehicles, infrared image of plate interpretation, date and time, latitude and longitude, information on who the system is, the nearest address, nearest information, and also they pick up speed and direction. This is some of the new technology. Some of the new technology is also being integrated with facial recognition, and that is part of an article down the lane. On pages 12 and 13, you have what the BCA has of their database, which is a hot files, warrants, missing persons. Many locals also have local databases. They develop their own. An elected official who decided in the other body decided to go on a ride-along to see how LPR works in their county sheriffs. And one thing that came up to them, how easy it was for locals to put in people's names with a particular license plate, and which is an interesting thing. The other articles that go through here that talk about the DEA, the sharing, and those kinds of things. I do have issues currently with the legislative Senate File 86. The point for me, Mr. Chairman, is this. License plate is not to be used as a type of identification to have government in its bowels of files where and when, where they go, what activities they do, you know, all those kinds of things like that. It is to catch bad guys, but that's on the hits. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I agree with the Privacy Study Commission did, you as legislators did, except for one person who voted no. They suggested the alternative, which was at least zero. Yes, use LPRs, but use it only with one database for specific purposes. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's my testimony, and I hope the information has been helpful.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Newmeister. Joseph Olson and Ben Feist.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Latz, my name is Joseph Olson. I'm a professor emeritus at Hamline University. I'm not appearing on their behalf. I'm also president of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance, and I am appearing on their behalf. We are concerned with some issues that are raised by the bill. One, I think, if you look at the initial presentation from the Chiefs Association, these are not being used as tracking devices at the moment. But if you set up a series of readers in strategic locations, you could certainly do that. It's not networked across jurisdictions. That's simply a software problem. It's not capturing every Minnesota plate, but I'll bet you over 90 days, once these get into all of the Minnesota agencies instead of just 17%, which is simply a matter of money, that it will have in it at any given time everyone's license plate number, which means this is going to be a big system. This is going to be a system that covers every Minnesotan. This is going to be a system that will allow the police to follow someone from one place to another by strategically locating license plate readers. You know, once you drive by and they check you and you're not a hit, you know, you ought to be left alone. I spent, I'm almost 70. I've worked very hard in those 70 years to earn no police record, to earn a federal security clearance, to be someone who gets cleared through the federal NICS check in less than a second. I don't want to be stalked by the police. I don't want to be in their database, and our members don't. There are some further questions here which are, I think, more important. One of them is the First Amendment question. There's nothing in the bill that prevents a police department during this time of the year when there are probably one gun show in the metro area every weekend from parking across from each one, from recording all of the attendees, and at the end of 90 days, you have a pretty good list of who goes to gun shows, which is a First Amendment associational freedom, which is also a First Amendment right of free speech freedom, which is going to be chilled or can be chilled if LP, these machines can be used for that purpose. It's simple enough to prohibit it. I think you should do that if you adopt the bill at all. Having no retention, of course, does that automatically. So we have serious First Amendment problems. The bill doesn't address derived data at all. Let's take my example of the gun shows. We have the LPR data, the raw LPR data, and then we have the list of who's been to two or more gun shows in the past 90 days. That's a derived list. There's nothing in here that says the derived list can't be shared with anyone and can't be kept forever. A problem with sharing is if you share the information with any federal agency, it's gone forever. The Minnesota legislature can't make rules for them. They wouldn't recognize them even if you tried. We know that by the handout that I gave out to you, that mission creep always shows up. It showed up at the federal level. It will show up at the Minnesota level if this bill doesn't have something that prevents it. And certainly zero retention will prevent it. I suppose a more complex provision might do the same thing. Someone asked a question earlier, well, what do we do about making sure that we can enforce these limitations? That's really not a problem. You create a private cause of action with attorney's fees and expenses, and you let the individual who is harmed sue.
Mr. Olson, I just need to do a little housekeeping. Apparently, cell phones are too close to our microphones. If we could take them off the table, that's interfering with the audio and the video feed. Thank you. Mr. Olson.
So there is a way of dealing with that situation. I have another. As I was reading over the bill, I like having there be state standards. But why aren't they being drafted by the Department of Public Safety? Why are they being drafted by the Post Board, which normally doesn't draft standards for how police departments operate? They don't operate a police department. The Department of Public Safety does. It's called the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Why aren't they doing it? Why isn't there a requirement that there be at least one or two non-police persons on the board, on the group that makes the decisions? You know, I know I've sent in written comments on a lot of legislation. Sometimes it's read, sometimes it's not. But if you're sitting there and you're part of the process and you can write a minority report, people tend to listen to you. So I think you might consider that. And the last thing is, if there is a model standard, then why not simply make everyone follow it instead of having 860 different customized versions for this town and that town? Why not have the rules be identical? And, of course, the easiest way to solve all of this is simply to have zero retention. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Feist.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Benjamin Feist. I'm legislative director for the ACLU of Minnesota. I'll keep my comments short today. First off, we do appreciate the efforts of Senator Latz to improve this bill as it's gone through committee. However, we still have concerns regarding the retention period and privacy protections. License plate readers do more than automate what police officers have always done in running license plates manually. Before this technology, the government did not have a digital database of the historical location of every vehicle that passed by each of its cameras. Contrary to some of law enforcement's assertions today, ALPRs are being used as tracking devices because the data they collect and retain can recreate an individual's movements. This technology can be used to track the movements of people who attend a protest or political event, attend a particular place of worship, or visit a particular doctor. We believe that it's a core principle in our society that the government does not invade people's privacy and collect information about a citizen's innocent activities just in case they do something wrong in the future. For that reason, we support zero retention of non-hit data on innocent Minnesotans. If the legislature decides to allow retention of non-hit data, the retention period should be stated in days or weeks, not months. If there is retention, there should also be a requirement that law enforcement obtain a court order or warrant in order to view this sensitive information that is collected on innocent people. This approach would still allow law enforcement to access ALPR data for all of the investigations that were cited today, as judges could quickly issue an order for access in those cases while providing an important oversight function. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Feist. All right, members, the time is short. Senator Latz, I'm guessing you want to rebut a few items. Why don't I give you the opportunity to do that and then open it up for some questions. I have a few questions. I'll just put State Patrol folks on notice. I have a few questions for you, so I'll invite you forward in just a moment. Thank you. Senator Latz.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to use up most of the rest of your committee time rebutting things, so I'd rather spend most of the time hearing and addressing the concerns of the members of the committee, so I'll try to keep my response here very short. I didn't have an opportunity, but I do want to express my condolences as well to the Mendota Heights Police Department on the loss of Officer Patrick, and note that the person, Brian Fitch, was convicted recently and will be spending the rest of his life in jail as a result of that killing. I will also note that one incident that was not addressed here, but solving the crime committed by the Boston Marathon bomber, was also LPR data was also used in solving that crime. LPR historical data, meaning data that had been retained that could be accessed for investigative purposes. I will note that with regard to the warrant suggestion from Mr. Feist, it's a bit awkward and I would suggest a bit time-consuming, and unnecessarily so, for law enforcement to seek a warrant to access their own databases. And that's essentially what they would be doing, because they'd be collecting data as law enforcement data and then using that to cross-check against other law enforcement-related databases. The other guardrails that are in this bill, I would submit more than adequately protect that, including the requirement of a reasonable suspicion relating to its use for a particularized investigation that's involved. With regard to the federal agency concern that was raised by Professor Olson, the bill does require already that the data cannot be shared with another agency unless that other agency also has the same protections in place. So by statute, if the federal agency did not agree to maintain the same level of protection, then the Minnesota agency couldn't share it with the federal agency. As a matter of practice, what happens is a federal agency may turn to the local agency and say, we're looking for this information. Can you run this license plate against your own database, rather than transferring the LPR database to the federal agency? That doesn't happen. With regard to the question of derived data, I'm not entirely sure how to respond to that. I'm willing to listen and talk with Professor Olson a little bit further about that. And I'm not sure that the bill specifically covers it and whether derived data that would be protected in the same way that the underlying raw data is protected. So I'd want to look further into that. So there are a number of – oh, and the issue was also raised about the Legislative Commission. I did not serve on the commission. My understanding is that it was a somewhat less formal proceeding over the course of its meetings than formal legislative committee hearings like this would be, that – at least I think 5 of the 8 members of the commission already had a position on this particular question before they were appointed to the commission. I know one member voted no, and there was one member who was absent who I understand, had he been present, took a position different than the position that came out of the commission. So I think what's probably more important is that we have the discussion here and independently consider what to do with regard to the retention period. The only other thing I'm going to add, and this is all I'm going to say about it in light of the chairman's earlier comments, is that the question of the retention of law enforcement data and the period of that retention is quintessentially a data practices question, which is within the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee. And so I would resist any efforts by this committee to roam into that other committee's jurisdiction to make changes. But that's all I'm going to say about that topic here today. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you. So I, with the committee's indulgence, I'm going to try to get through a few questions. I mean, the actual reason why the bill is here is about some of the practices and services by the state agency over which we have jurisdiction, both some jurisdiction over their resources as well as their policies and practices. So Lieutenant Colonel Schroefer, if you wouldn't mind coming forward, I have a series of questions. I'll try to get through them quickly, just so we can find some basic information. First of all, thank you for being here. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, my name is Shelley Schroefer. I'm a Lieutenant Colonel for the Minnesota State Patrol.
Great. Thank you. So just very quickly, how long does the State Patrol utilizes automatic license plate readers, correct?
That is correct. We've got 12 units.
All right.
That are in operation.
And are they mounted on squads?
They are.
Great. Thank you. And how long does the State Patrol retain the data?
48 hours.
Great. I know one of the – would the passage of this bill, in your view, require that the data be retained for 90 days, or is it flexible, and do we read it as up to
– For our purposes, mm-hmm. Our policy states 48 hours, and we would not change our policy if the – retention rate went to 90 days, we'd stay at 48 hours.
Okay. Now I'm going to argue the other side of the question a little bit. Would this not disadvantage then someone who might be wanting to utilize that data for exculpatory purposes?
It potentially could. For our purposes, and we have a little different use of the data than the traditional law enforcement agencies, many of the chiefs of who you've heard from today, we use the data really in terms of traffic safety. That's our main focus for the data. Our focus is to try to ensure that the safety on the roads is the benefit from using the ALPR devices. Statistically, data has showed that 2.2 times more likely that a revoked or suspended driver, an unlicensed driver, is going to be involved in a fatal crash. Non-licensed drivers are 4 times more likely than valid licensed drivers to be involved in any kind of traffic accident. So the State Patrol's focus is really to utilize these devices in terms of traffic safety and ensuring that we are removing those non-licensed drivers off the roadway. In addition, obviously, we do remove stolen vehicles from the roadway and other vehicles that we get hit data on once the data is confirmed as valid.
So that brings up another serious question. So I assume through the
license plate data, there's a connection then to driver's license, the driver's license database.
As if a trooper is in a squad with a license plate reader, and mind you, that trooper's been trained on how to use that device. We don't transfer those devices from squad to squad. Trooper who's using the ALPR device has to be trained in the use of that device. And if the vehicle, if we get a hit on a vehicle that the trooper passes by if the vehicle is stationary, one of the things that we have to do is we have to confirm that hit information. So we don't act solely upon the hit that the LPR device presents to the trooper. The trooper then has to independently confirm that information. Typically, we do that through the DVS database. So, and one of the reasons we do that is the hot list of information that's downloaded onto the trooper's laptop at the beginning of a shift is data that is maybe only as current as the last time it was updated onto that laptop. So the hot list that resides on a trooper's laptop may have been downloaded at 8 a.m. that morning. At noon, that trooper may get a hit on data that was on that hot list. Let's say that the subject of that data hit has revoked driver's license. Right? The owner of a vehicle that hit, the owner shows revoked. Maybe at 10 a.m. they stopped on a DVS at the courts and they resolve that revocation issue and they are now valid. Well, the hot list being loaded on at 8 a.m. that morning would show that that owner still has a revoked driver's license status. 10 a.m., they went down, resolved their issues, they became valid. So it's imperative that the troopers, once we get that hit, we compare it to the real-time database that exists out there to ensure that that data is legit.
Great. That helps. Does that database, that independent verification of the driver and vehicle services, driver's license data, then also reflect those instances where folks have a limited driver's license or, continues, perhaps have paid their, in the instance of a revoked, have paid their portion of their reinstatement fee? Is that data available when they do that independent verification?
That independent verification would present that information.
Okay, great. So when you do have a hit and it shows that someone is revoked and shouldn't be driving or the owner of the vehicle, what is the standard by which you have a legal cause to pull someone over?
Yeah, the hit data that comes from the LPR is not reasonable cause or reasonable suspicion or probable cause to stop that driver. If we get that hit information, we then verify that hit information through the DVS database. The other thing that we need to do is we need to ensure that John Doe owns the vehicle and the hit information is on John Doe. We may run John Doe then in the DVS database, which is a real-time query. John Doe may be revoked. We then need to get close enough to the vehicle and the driver, and if we see that Sally Doe is driving, we've got no legitimate reason to stop that vehicle. So there's a confirmation that has to happen for us to be able to articulate that we believe that the owner of that vehicle is actually driving that car.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that. So the Department of Public Safety, State Patrol owns the ALPRs?
We own 12 units. That's correct.
You own them. Okay. And how frequently do they have to be serviced, updated, or replaced?
I'm not sure what our service date is on that. I do have... Lieutenant Zach, can you answer that?
Infrequently. They don't require
any checks. Okay. So infrequently.
And how are they paid for? Out of what source of funds?
All of our units, all 12 of our units, were paid for with grant money. The grant funding came through the Department of Commerce, and it was actually money that came from the insurance industry with the intent to recover stolen vehicles. Keeping the insurance costs down. And year-to-date, so far, we've recovered 30 stolen vehicles in which we've been able to save the insurance companies as well as the taxpayers' money.
Great. Thank you. And then there's a requirement in the bill for a triennial independent audit. And triennial, Senator Latz, is once every 3 years, not three times a year.
That's correct.
I think we've been having this discussion. Triannual is three times a year. Triennial is once every 3 years. So we have another vocabulary lesson. I know the fiscal note reflects like $5,000 to the post board, resources out of existing funds for BCA and State Patrol. But there's no discussion of this independent audit, which I assume someone else in state government or an independent contractor would need to be hired and paid to conduct that. How do you anticipate paying for that?
You know, I suspect we would use existing grant money if there is anything there. There's another grant that's going to be presenting itself fairly soon for use of these systems. I don't suspect that the cost for that is going to be very high or time-consuming for us. Because we only retain our data for 48 hours, the audit would only be looking at 48 hours worth of data. And that's, I guess, one of the advantages of having, you know, for the State Patrol, for the low retention rate, it would help us in that audit would be a fairly quick process.
Well, I think the audit is, you know, to Senator Latz's credit, is a little more thorough to make sure that whatever agency is using LPRs is in full compliance with the provisions of the law. Okay, well, that helps, but I would ask, I know this is going to finance, that we just take a fresh look at the fiscal note, the fiscal note on its way to finance. That's the extent of my questions. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question for the State Patrol
and
as
members,
well.
Members, we're over time, but I don't want to hang up Senator Latz. I don't know if you all have to be somewhere, but I would like to get through this and finish this. If this is all right with members, I'll just get a sense of members. All right, great. All right, I'm sorry. So we'll go with Senator Peterson, and then we'll have Senator Franz, and then Senator Osmond. Thank you, Senator
Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Lieutenant Colonel. You mentioned briefly.
Question you just raised.
Oh, yes.
Are you planning to go another half hour, 2 hours to finish
today? Why don't we establish?
The reason I ask, I do have a meeting at 3:30 that I was committed to.
Oh, okay.
I do want to be here for this debate, so I don't know if it's going to extend into next Monday. I'd be more likely to try to get going than.
Well, are you able to stay with us? Can we stay until 4 members?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Can you stay with us till 4? Come back. Are you retrievable?
I'm skeptical that will be done by 4, Mr. Chair.
Well, if we're not done by 4, we'll just hold it over until Monday. All right. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lieutenant Colonel, you mentioned briefly that your enforcement activities are very different than local law enforcement. So my question relates to that. You know, it sounded like you have a different use. My sense is that, or my recollection is that Minnesota has kind of a decentralized law and criminal justice system. So the State Patrol is focused on the roadways and traffic, commercial vehicles, and that type of thing. So does the State Patrol get involved in investigating of larceny or burglary at all?
That would be a very rare situation that we would do that.
What would happen, Mr. Chair?
Senator Peterson.
Lieutenant Crowell, what would happen, for example, if a State Patrol officer discovered a large amount of drugs in a vehicle? Is that something you would handle, or would that be turned over to another agency, or how would you handle that?
Senator Peterson, we would handle that, and we do have a large number of troopers who are out there every day working the roadways, and they do encounter controlled substances, and we certainly make arrests on that.
Okay, thank you.
That's it, Mr. Chair.
Senator Franzen, I believe, was next.
Madam Chair, and I just want to start by not thanking all the testifiers and thanking Senator Letts for his effort with this bill. I was I guess lucky enough to have Chief Potts take some time with Commander Elliott to educate not only myself but a few other members in the Senate and House about the license plate reader technology. So we actually had the presentation and also visited with Commander Elliott and really understood how the program is applied. So other than just reading the bill, it's hard to really have a sense of what this does until you actually witness it. And I had concerns because I was frankly ignorant of how it really was applied. So after that tour, my concerns were pretty much dealt with, and I saw the value of the retention period. I saw the value of how it's being used, and certainly in the day and time when we have threats to the Mall of America and others. Just today, I don't know if you saw in the news, in New York, there's also three suspects that are allegedly part of recruiting for ISIS. We live in different times, and I like to have the public safety community on my side and to make sure that they are using this information for public safety. And that's why I support this bill. I think the reference here, the parameters of how this information is used, it needs to be used for legitimate, which I interpret that to be legal reasons, for specific reasons, which I would imagine that would mean because you have a reason to get that information, and that it also requires you to have documented law enforcement purpose. And how I interpret that, I don't know if it's defined in the bill, a crime with reasonable suspicion under the language of the bill. So those parameters really give me comfort of that this information is going to be used for these legitimate purposes. I also learned, and this is not subject for today, but that this technology is being used in the private sector already, and that's not something covered by this bill, but certainly that concerns me because we have no ability to regulate that at this point. This is not what that bill is doing. But insurance companies and other companies are using license plate readers today, and that actually concerns me a lot more than this bill that we have in front of us, members. Not to belabor that point, but I do have some questions. I had the question on the federal connection, if the federal government could use this information if we were using it jointly for a crime and how that would work. So you sort of answered that question, Senator Latz, although I do still don't feel comfortable that the federal doesn't preempt how we use the data. So maybe we can clarify that a little bit better to the extent that we can legally restrict the federal government from using that information. So some reference there would give me some more comfort. My question is with regard to Section 3.1 of the bill, when it talks about who is able to give essentially consent to using this information. And the database, you can use the chief of police, sheriff, or head of law enforcement agency, or their designee. How could that be, and how would that authority be designated? That's not clear to me as well in the bill. And we're giving specific people who can give that authority, but then their designee is kind of vague. So maybe some comfort language there, which would, or maybe even removing the designee. I don't know if there's a purpose why you have that language there, but certainly that was a question of mine. Other than that, again, I want to thank the Bloomington Police Department and the work you've done, and certainly the ability to really help me understand as a legislator and a policymaker how this is applied and how you can make it safer, and how I know that ACLU testified earlier, and I believe the comment was said that the data is viewed for things that are viewed in the future. The data is viewed in the future, but the data that's collected has an impact on the crime in real time. So I think that's a little confusing, but we're not necessarily surveilling people, innocent people. We're trying to catch people who are doing things at the time of the crime that's being committed, and that's, if evidence is helpful for that particular crime. We're just looking at the data in the future. So I think that's a little confusing as well. And I think that's all my questions in terms of how you can address a few of those. You don't have to talk to them about right now, but those are my concerns for the bill.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chair, I've been informed by some of the law enforcement representatives behind me that in terms of federal access to the data, that they would not have the direct access to the data. They would be looking for some information, and they would send a query basically to the local law enforcement agency that does have the data and ask the local agency, Bloomington Police Department, for example, to do the query through the Bloomington's law enforcement data that they've collected from LPR. So the data itself would not actually be transferred or within the possession or control of the federal government at any time. Secondly, there is, again, that protection that says they can't transfer to the federal government or a federal agency or any other agency unless that other agency also maintains the same levels of protection that are required in this bill. And finally, their designee reference, the bill throughout requires that the law enforcement agency itself comply with the law. So you, I don't think we could reasonably expect, for example, the Minneapolis police chief to personally approve every request for access to the data. So she, for example, might designate an assistant chief or someone else within the department to be the point person on that, to have that responsibility for review, and who would be answerable then to the chief ultimately on those questions. So because the whole agency is responsible for complying, I'd be awfully shocked if a chief were to designate someone outside the agency to have that kind of authority. So I would anticipate or their designee would mean someone within the governance structure of the agency itself.
Okay. Lieutenant Colonel, could you just respond quickly to your data sharing protocol with the federal government as it relates to this subject?
We have reporting requirements that we capture. There's a log that we have that we need to complete and capture and report back to the federal government. I'm not exactly sure. I don't have the data in front of me how often we do that, but I do know that we keep those records.
So I'm sorry if you could be a little more clear. What does that mean? What exactly do you share with the federal government with respect to license plate data?
There's a log that we keep which has information on it, the date, the hours worked, the total number of stops, number of citations.
But it's not individual hit data or
We do have the troopers who are using this equipment as well keep a log.
Okay, great. Thank you. Members, just so we have, we're clear on the order of folks who want to be recognized. We have Senator Osnick, Senator Westrum, Senator Kiffmeyer, Senator Carlson. Yeah, but I think Senator Kent had a question to this issue.
Yes.
So I'll recognize Senator Kent, and then we'll go to this order. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lieutenant Colonel, I just wanted to ask very quickly. So when troopers are doing their jobs out on the highways and they run a plate manually, is that kept, that information, that transaction, if you will, maintained somewhere?
Lieutenant Colonel.
Senator, the query that's made is kept. There's a record of that. Anytime we utilize what are called our MDC devices, our mobile data computers, there's a recording of that specific terminal and the plate, for example, of that individual terminal inquired about. I believe that's kept at BCA, I think, has a database that tracks that data.
Thank you.
All right.
And if I can just say one
sentence,
because a reference has been made a couple of times about the Legislative Commission on Data Practices, and there was a no vote. That was me. I just want to make that comment.
Great. Senator Osmick.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the A-15 amendment.
All right. Senator Osmick moves the A-15 amendment.
While it's being passed out, I'd sure like to talk to us so we can move things along.
Yeah, go ahead. And I think we have a hunch what it is.
Yep, this is the zero retention amendment. While I think that we all agree that license plate readers are an important tool for law enforcement, I think the discussion we have here in the Senate is, where is the line? Is the line 90 days? Is the line 30 days? Is the line zero? And I'd like to dispose of finding out the pleasure of the committee to find out if the pleasure of the committee is that it is a zero retention rate. My opinion is that it is. I spoke briefly with Senator Latz before the meeting. I have very serious concerns about data being taken out of our jurisdictional control and brought to the federal government, where it can sit regardless of what our law says, regardless of what we intend upon having imposed upon for rules in the federal government. I have very serious concerns that it can go to the federal government. We will never know if they follow our rules. That being said, I'm not going to belabor the point. I would like to see like this amendment on. I wouldn't have any problem with the 90-day, but I like this particular option the best. So with that, I'll leave it to the members of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Osmick. Questions, members, on the A-15? Senator Westrum.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was going to ask some questions that relates to this amendment, the similar, same as the bill. But if that's all right, Mr. Chair, maybe to the author, just Anyway. First of all, Senator Kent, I thought, raised a good point. Senator Latz, manually, when a license plate is read now, what, maybe the chiefs or somebody have a better answer. State Patrol sounds like they keep them for a little while. I'm not clear on how many days they keep that information currently. Do you know?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, I mean, when they run a manual
license plate,
how long?
Because they do that now, as I understand. It's just it's manual. Officer has to see a license plate, note that it's 252JRL, and then they run that information. That's similar, checked against a database, if I understand it correctly, just like the license plate reader does. Assuming I'm correct on that, how long do they keep that information now? There's a chief or somebody else that wants to answer that. That's fine.
So there's a little conferral going on at the table right now, so we'll wait a moment.
Mr. Chair, I'm informed by a representative from the BCA that the BCA does keep an auditable log or record of each query that is made. That a particular license plate was being run against other databases to see, for example, if the vehicle was stolen or if the registered owner was not licensed to drive. And that log and that of that query is maintained she believes, 7 years. It does not include location data, as far as I can tell you at this moment. It's simply a query as to the status of that plate's registered owner or the vehicle itself.
So Senator Latz, if I understand that right, the queries now then don't keep what data the license plate reader would keep. It indicates that license plate XYZ was checked, but it doesn't say XYZ was found in Minnetonka at this date and this point of time. So you couldn't corroborate that John Doe was in that location. Am I understanding that right?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, as far as I'm aware, that's correct.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, I'm Dana Goetz. I'm the director of the Minjus Division at BCA. Yes, so we would keep anything that's part of the original query in our audit log at BCA.
And Ms. Goetz, is location of the car or vehicle part of that log right now for 7 years?
Ms. Goetz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, I'm not positive. I would have to check and get back to the committee.
Okay.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Goetz, I'd be interested to know that. I think it would be insightful. But thank you. Thank you for that information. Senator Latz, I'll kind of ask you these questions, and then maybe whoever has the insight could offer it. Mr. Gemberling talked about what database are we checking this against, and I guess that's what I would like to know a little more. What are the parameters that we're going to keep in place? So we're just checking for stolen cars. Or does this allow just fishing expeditions to go on, much like a checkpoint stop would just do if we put up checkpoints on half of our state highways? What parameters keep it from doing that?
Senator Latz.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, the testimony, as I understood it, was that the databases that would be checked would be the databases maintained by Driver and Vehicle Services, which would include driver's license data and motor vehicle registration data, as well as the hot list that they update periodically to check for information about stolen vehicles or warrants out for the registered owners, and so those hot lists that they maintain. So those would be the basic databases, and those are all under current law accessible by law enforcement officers in the ordinary course of their responsibilities. The difference here is that there's an automated process that can do it rather than just a manual process, so they can capture the information more quickly and are capable of retaining it, and significantly for purposes of this bill, geotagging it, so providing the location information for the vehicle that is identified. And that's the information that is most valuable for purposes of investigations that may occur 2 days later or 3 weeks later or whatever the case is, if they're trying to solve a separate crime where that location would be significant.
And Senator Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, where is the line drawn on offenses? Somebody is a barber or a cosmetologist practicing without a license, and they have a violation. They haven't paid their state or federal taxes, and the Department of Revenue wants to, would like to know where these people live. The Department of Commerce has a reported violation against them. Where do we draw the line of what data will be used against somebody? Is it just stolen vehicles and criminal activity? Do we? I mean, we now allow the departments in many cases to cross tab a lot of information on our constituents and find out where they are, or if they're started another business, or they maybe owe some back taxes. Where is it going to stop on the license plate readers, or is all of that fair game? Maybe that is my understanding. Is it may not be, but I'd like to know that.
Senator Latz.
Yes,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, the questions you raise are good ones, but they're not related to this bill, because this bill refers only to law enforcement investigations of crimes. And access to the law enforcement databases that law enforcement currently accesses. So it includes the databases that I've referenced. I suppose if the Department of Revenue were able to obtain an arrest warrant for a person because of whatever their investigation involves, I don't know, they'd get a warrant for someone who hasn't maintained their barber's license current. But if they did, then there would be a warrant out signed by a judge, and that warrant would go into the database for law enforcement to check against. But I'm not aware that, you know, law enforcement does investigations on anything other than criminal activity.
Okay, two questions left.
Senator
Latz, the State Patrol indicated that your bill would, or their practice, and I'd like to know this from all law enforcement, if that's true or if there's a difference in application. They indicated you've now got a hit on your license plate reader, but Jane Doe is borrowing John Doe's car. That's an easy distinction, but what if John Doe's brother is borrowing John Doe's car? What precautions are there from John Doe's brother from being pulled over because he's driving John Doe's car, which is the hit? Granted, not probably a stolen vehicle, but some other license plate hit that came up. What is the practice to prevent vehicles being pulled over without reasonable suspicion?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, this actually gets into a kind of a separate area of the law, but the basic law, as I recall, is a little bit broader than the way it was described by the Lieutenant Colonel from the State Patrol. If a license plate, and this comes up in appellate case laws where this has basically been decided, articulable reasonable suspicion for a stop of a motor vehicle, if you identify the registered owner as having had a revoked license, for example, and mm-hmm. you do this, the officer manually runs a plate on their mobile data computer in the squad car. If they don't have any information and they can't tell who's driving the vehicle before the stop is made, then they can make an assumption that the driver of the vehicle is the registered owner of the vehicle, and they can stop it. But that's based on a reasonable, articulable suspicion that a crime is occurring, that a person is driving the vehicle who is not licensed to drive the vehicle or has a warrant for their arrest, for example. If they are able to see anything about the driver of the vehicle and determine that it does not match the description of the registered owner, then they do not have lawful basis for stopping that vehicle. So if they've got the driver's license picture shows that the registered owner has dark black hair and the person driving the vehicle is a brother who has light sandy brown hair, and you know, you can tell sometimes how tall a person is when they're sitting in a vehicle. If they're barely above, if the back of their head is barely above the headrest, it's, you know, or, and the driver's license data says they're 5'3", or the license data says they're 6'5", you can tell some information about that too. And so if you've got some reason to believe that the driver was not the registered owner of the vehicle, you don't have a basis for stopping the vehicle just solely because of that hit.
And last question, Senator Latz. What is, I mean, this gets to the technology and it gets to the retention of the data. What is the current law or policy on just setting up criminal checkpoints on our highways? We generally don't allow them, but what is the difference from this technology and
point of order,
Senator Francis,
we would, are we sticking to the amendment? We're debating the amendment. I don't know if this is related to the amendment. In the interest of time,
right? We only have a couple of more minutes. I believe that the answers to these questions is informing how Senator Westrom will vote on the A-15. Is that correct, Senator Westrom?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom.
And the retention of data, Mr. Chair. But Senator Latz, I think you got the gist of my question.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, under the U.S. Supreme Court decision, Michigan versus Sitz, and the Minnesota decisions following that language, checkpoints are not lawful in Minnesota. So checkpoints are completely random stops of vehicles. The stop itself is the intrusion on the freedom of movement or travel of an individual. So the license plate reader data is not stopping a vehicle. It's observing a publicly traveling vehicle and gathering information on its location at that time in the event that it becomes useful within whatever the retention period turns out to be.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Kiffmeyer on the A. Quick questions on the A-15 before we go to a vote. Senator
Yes, thank
Kiffmeyer.
You, Mr. Chairman. Not a question, but just a comment. One thing that sort of sparked to me, and I did a little research while I was listening here, on the Constitution, in particular the Fourth Amendment. And it talks about probable cause. And I think in this day and age, while we are concerned about public safety, we also ought to be concerned
about, thank you, we also ought to be concerned about a primary issue that is equally as important, if not more important, because of that. So we have a presumption of innocence. That's really important. And so when I read the language and I've listened to the testimony, I look at this and say, you can retain it in any format, especially based upon the stolen vehicle. There's a warrant for the arrest, or the owner has a suspended or revoked driver's license, or the data are active investigative data. So it releases our law enforcement, which we greatly all appreciate, to be able to maintain that data for that, because there has been a proven situation that your connection with this vehicle has a probable cause situation. The rest of the data does not, and so I believe it should not be retained. Just because you can in this digital era doesn't mean you should, or just because you can doesn't mean I gave up my right to have a presumption of innocence. If you don't have a probable cause, you do not have the right to deal with that data. And so this is a really important to me, a principle decision that is very important. And because I see here that law enforcement in their probable cause and their data collection does have access and can retain it, the rest of it for law-abiding citizens or you don't have probable cause should not be retained. And so I think it's a well-written amendment that I think gives a balanced protection to both. And I hope, Mr. Chairman, that we can pass and place this amendment on the bill.
Okay, thank you. We're over time. We're going to try to get to this vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the amendment, I did a little research myself as well for this, to compare ourselves with other states in terms of the retention period. The ones I came up with: New Jersey, 5 years; Arkansas, 150 days; Maine, 21 days; Tennessee, 90 days; Utah, 30 days; Vermont, 18 months. My question to Senator Latz is: are you aware of any states that have no guidance in terms of the retention period, that it's unlimited time? Do you know of any states that just basically keep the information forever?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Franzen, in consultation with the law enforcement sitting behind me, we're not aware of any states off the top of our heads that are unlimited and don't have any retention periods at all. Most of them have, the ones that we know of, have specified limits on the retention. If we do nothing in Minnesota this year, then it remains unlimited and public for that matter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator
Lett. All right. Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would have a question to the amendment author. Senator Osmond, could you just touch on what you think I'll call it the last phrase of this amendment means, or the data are active investigative data? It seems kind of wide open to me, but I just wanted to get your author interpretation.
Senator Osmond.
Senator Senjum, so you're saying where are you starting at?
On line 15.
Okay.
At the end, or the data are active investigative data.
The intent on that, Senator Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, the intent on that is to allow data that is, if there is an active investigation, if the person's on a hot sheet, if the person's on a hot list, that data can be retained for an active investigation where there is cause to keep the information.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Okay, so members, the list is growing, and we are fully 35 minutes over committee time. I think we're going to just put this bill on the table and come back on Monday. All right? That we are adjourned.
There you are.